Wham Talk Radio. It's the Snark Factor. I'm Fingers Malloy, and we are going to talk to Carol Roth for the entire hour. She's a New York Times bestselling author, great friend of the show. She has a new book coming out. It's called You Will Own Nothing. It's a book I believe you really need to get your hands on. It's available for pre-sale right now on Amazon.com. It will be available at bookstores everywhere July 18th. Let's just get right into the conversation. Carol Roth for the entire hour on the Snark Factor. Welcome back to Wham Talk Radio. I'm Fingers. She is Sarah. This is the Snark Factor. And I'm so excited to have our next guest on the show because she has written a very important book that needs to be in your hands. It's called You Will Own Nothing, Your War with a New Financial World Order and How to Fight Back. It's our good friend, Carol Roth. Carol, welcome back to the Snark Factor. It's been a long time. How are you?
It's good. Good. I'm so happy to be back at the Snark Factor. I feel like something's been missing in my life, and it's the being at the Snark Factor. So happy to be back snarking it up with you guys.
Well, we're going to do our best to make light of a bad situation, which we often try to do here. But let's just begin with, you know, we know about big government and how big tech has become too powerful. But there are groups out there like the World Economic Forum. Who are these people? And what threat do they pose to everyday Americans?
So the World Economic Forum is an international non-governmental organization that's basically comprised of the global elite. And I know that always sounds so, you know, kind of out there. But if you think about the people who are running businesses globally, the people who are entrenched in governments globally, some of the academic leaders, even some, you know, celebrities and other hangers-on, they have this very fancy networking event that people may have heard of every January in Davos, Switzerland. You know, just a place really lowbrow. You have to fly your private jet up to Davos, Switzerland, to go to this get together, you know, to share very important ideas, because obviously these are very important people.
Right.
And for some of them, I mean, that's exactly what it is. It's a snotty boondoggle. You go, you have steak, you eat caviar, you clink champagne glasses and, you know, laugh at the other plebs around the world. And ha ha ha, they're not here in Davos with us. But a lot of really dangerous ideas have come out of this organization. And it sounds very conspiratorial when you talk about it. But then when you just kind of put everything into context, the call, the information is out there. It's in their own words. So the title of the book, You Will Own Nothing, is directly from the World Economic Forum. It is from their 8 predictions for 2030, which comes from their Global Futures Council. Those are the people who had the input, and frankly was repackaged from the same ideas. It's one of the things they like to do, that they take the same bad ideas and just change the names, repackage them until they catch on. But their number one prediction for 2030 was you'll own nothing and you'll be happy. And that really stood out to me, because when I heard this going around social media many years ago, it was like, okay, so we just said this is the business elite and the political elite and the academic elite, and they're predicting the end of private property within several years' time. Like, this is right around the corner. Someone must have gotten this wrong. Like, that this must have been completely out of context. But as I said, the research is actually quite easy to do. It's still on their Twitter feed and, you know, places on YouTube, although I don't think their official YouTube channel anymore. And you can go and you can see the video with all of their horrible predictions. That's the one that gets the most attention, but there are 8 of them, basically. Yeah. And so, you know, as somebody who's spent my entire career trying to help other people build and retain wealth, you know, I'm like the champion for the American dream. I want everybody to participate in it. It was very staggering to me, because if you think about what makes people wealthy, it's ownership. That's where it starts with. You own assets and they hopefully retain and appreciate in value, retain their value and appreciate in value. And that's how people build wealth. So it's pretty staggering that you've got these people who are saying you have no property rights, and then by extension, you'll have no wealth. And you'll be happy because, you know, I'm not the biggest student of history, but from what I've studied, and I'm sure you're more informed than I am on this, Fingers, but the people who have not had property have been quite unfree and fairly miserable. Many of them have ended up dead. So I don't really feel like that's a good outcome. And as I was looking at all of these different trends that were impacting the American dream and people's ability to get and retain wealth, it just kept coming back to this prediction of you will own nothing.
It launched in the 70s. Am I correct?
71.
71.
Yeah.
And it sounded like a good idea in theory, right? It's like, okay, we'll get a bunch of business leaders together and we'll talk about the economy and business. And I think, and it's grown into this behemoth that if you didn't know any better, if you were just looking at what's been said there, you would think it was straight out of an Austin Powers movie and Dr. Evil is running the show. It's absolutely crazy.
Yeah, I mean, the guy who's running it is right out of central casting for Austin Powers version 5 or, you know, whatever the future one is. But he, you know, I'll give him credit for being one persistent MFer, because like you said, he came up with this idea in 1971. And he not only launched it, it was originally called something like the European Management Forum, I believe, in 71. And he came up with this idea of stakeholder capitalism. And again, that's an oxymoron in and of itself, and also kind of speaks to the you will own nothing philosophy built into it. Because if you own something, you're a shareholder, like you have ownership in it. Stakeholder is all these kind of people running around the periphery that really have nothing to do with the business, but are now imposing their will on it. So from the beginning, he's always had this sort of communist Marxist philosophy. And he started this in Europe. And then, you know, early or kind of mid-70s, there were a bunch of geopolitical crises. He saw that as an opportunity to get political leaders together, kind of brought them in, then started bringing in people from the U.S. And this, it just kind of grew. And he has been at it and saying the same things that are nuttier than a jar of peanut butter over and over and over again since 71, right? So that's like 50 some odd years this guy's been at it. And yeah, he is very committed to the cause. And, you know, it's for the children, guys. I mean, that, you know, we all know that he's just doing this for the good of humanity. By the way, it's very funny, too, because the guy, this Klaus Schwab, who runs it, you know, he'll talk about CEO pay and inequality, but he takes a salary that's the equivalent of about $1 million a year. They have these, you know, this Davos networking event. They get the Swiss government to pay for some of the security there. I think, and it's in the book, the operating budget is something around the equivalent of $300 million a year. Oh, and good news is we all fund it.
So not
only are we funding it indirectly through the companies that we, you know, go and spend our dollars with and them spending their dollars to be part of this, but part of our tax dollars goes to World Economic Forum, which seems to make lots and lots of sense. And, you know, this has happened both under, you know, Trump and, you know, the Obama Biden regimes. So, you know, this isn't something that's like, oh, well, you know, all of a sudden we pulled out of it and now they're back in. Everybody seems to be a part of it. So not only are these terrible ideas being populated and then, you know, they're seeping back in, I think in some cases, just through useful idiots, and we may talk about some of the ideas like ESG being carried through business leaders, most of which have no idea what that even means or where it came from. And well, some
it,
of them
it means they're good people, Carol. That's what it means. It means that they're good people, right?
Yes. So, yeah. And you know what happens, Sarah? If you're a good person, you can put an emoji in your bio. You can wear the I'm a good person t-shirt.
Yeah, wear your little ribbon.
You can have a ribbon. Mm-hmm. And if you don't wear a ribbon, apparently, according to Kramer and that episode of Seinfeld, you get beat up. You can put a sign in your yard that you're a good person.
Yes.
And one day soon, it will probably get you points on your social credit score, which all ties in to this you'll own nothing philosophy too. So yeah, you get to be a good person on the back of our tax dollars. and it all kind of seeps back in. But so, you know, some of it's very intentional. Some of the people are very clear about what they're doing. And there's a whole lot of people who are like, well, I can just make a buck out of this. We call them the profiteers or the racketeers. And then they're the useful idiots who get the emojis and hats and ribbons. And, you know, all of that comes together to just completely screw us over.
Well, you go into great detail in this book about the social credit system, specifically in China. And you do talk a lot about how the social credit system is used as not the only aspect, the only way, but the weaponization of the dollar, right? Like how they use currency to punish people, whether on a global scale or more of a micro scale. I would love for you to expand a little bit more on that idea of the weaponization of the dollar, the great consolidation, like these sorts of big picture things that are happening that the book runs. I mean, you really need to get your hands on this because it really does run through the histories, the backgrounds, gives you a lot of information to put into context what's happening right now in our economic system and in our social system. I think one of the big issues is that we have culturally equated wealth with greed, right? So wealth is automatically, it means, you know, there's something wrong with you if you're wealthy. You've become rich by off the backs of other people. And even that cultural idea that attacks the idea of wealth and ownership and private property is part of this whole big picture. And I'd love to hear more about that, of what you discovered in this like weaponization of the dollar aspect.
Well, sir, I'm going to actually just put you on the rest of my media tour because I feel like you've got all the key ingredients here. You could just do a better job than I can.
It was a great book.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Well, there's a lot of information to unpack just in that piece of what you said. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I tried to do, which hopefully you guys took away from it, is that I tried to take the conspiracy element out of this, right? Because, you know, the people who are talking about a lot of these things, let's just be clear, a lot of them are insane. And so it's hard to take what they're saying seriously. I have let, you know, the sources and the people do the talking. And, you know, these are, I'm using the NPRs and the New York Times and the Washington Post of the world, things from the White House's website, like stuff that like, it's kind of hard for you to all of a sudden go, no, well, this is a crazy conspiracy theory.
You go back into like Dutch and British empires. I mean, this is like historical context you're putting here, right?
Yeah, there's a lot. So let's start with China, and then we'll work our way back to social credit, and then we'll talk about the sort of financial mechanism to enforce it. So basically, China has a more formalized, developed social credit system than we do, probably one of the most formalized in the world, but it's still nascent. It's not as formalized as I think a lot of people believe, and so I think it's helpful to understand the nuance. So what they have is it's really kind of rolled out on a jurisdictional basis. And depending on where you live, it could be that you have a letter grade or you have a number grade. It's not standardized, you know, kind of like at the country level yet, although I'm sure that they will work on getting there. And so the things that are considered good and bad obviously depend on what's going on in that particular jurisdiction. So certainly not paying your debts is bad. They frown upon that. That's going to get you negative points. So is, you know, not visiting your elderly parents. So is saying bad things about the government on social media. So is cheating at video games and taking up too much room on an airplane, which on that one, I kind of give it to them. You know, like that's horrible. Okay. And maybe that should be part. No, I mean, like, it's a bad thing, but we don't want the government to be the one that's enforcing it. I think the airline can enforce that themselves. So, you know, those are the kinds of things that get you negative marks. And then on the good side, it's the flip side. If you go and visit your elderly parents, if you give blood, if you say nice things about the government, and then, you know, that's kind of today is considered good and bad, which is entirely frightening. But it really does start with the financial impact. And one of the stories that I share, which came from NPR, is of a gentleman named Lao Duan, who was a coal intermediary in China. And so he's the sort of middleman in the coal industry. And the government one day up and decided they were going to change their policy on coal, and his business just got completely pummeled. He was on the wrong side of it. And so he ended up in debt because of the government's decision, right? Like just literally overnight, didn't plan for, hey, we're going to help these people out. So he is now on the blacklist. And not only can he not travel and not have, you know, access to the same kinds of things that we all can, but one day he's walking through his town. He looks up and he sees his face on a billboard with his name and his untrustworthy number. And it says, this person's not trustworthy. Here's the guy's number. And as he's watching them kind of cycle by, he's noticing all of these other people from the coal industry that kind of had the same fate befall them. So very Orwellian. And so, you know, obviously the whole idea of money and opportunities, it's harder to get jobs. Your social standing is crushed. You know, all of these things that are related to how you earn a living, as well as having your picture on the untrustworthy billboard. So, you know, that's kind of what's happening there. Wow. Take that over to the U.S. and some people, probably not your listeners, but maybe people who sit around your listeners' table at, you know, Thanksgiving or Christmas, you know, might go, well, you know, that happens in China. We understand, but like, that's not going to happen here. And, you know, I tie it together with the fact that we already have non-formal social credit here. It started with cancel culture, and then COVID really accelerated it. And we certainly have the technology and the means for it to become formalized at any point in time. And living through the past several years, we all know that like your constitutional rights, you know, don't really mean as much as they used to. And if the government wants to at any level, they'll just go ahead and trample on them. So think about, you know, just what's happened recently. If you didn't get a vaccine, you know, if you decided that wasn't something that was for you, then you were considered a bad person. Maybe you weren't wearing a mask. You got yelled at. They came, they videotaped you. They put you on social media to try to crush your social standing. I mean, how much different is that than being on the billboard? It's you know, a couple of steps away from, right, from, hey, this is your social standing. We don't want you to have money. Then
instead of the government doing it, they've just turned it, the citizens are responsible
well,
for turning
and,
each other
and in some
right.
cases, it was the government, right?
Right,
so if we talk
true.
About them collaborating with Twitter and Facebook and things we don't like what these people are saying, yes. let's make kick them off the platform. They're not trustworthy. So they're killing their social standing and their ability to earn a living. In some cases, if you were not vaccinated, if you were in the military or the police or hospital or whatnot, they took away your job. So again, same kind of thing. You're a bad person and we're going to not let you earn a living from it. And they also just shut down businesses, like a third of the economy willy-nilly. So from their own mandates, based on what they thought was good and right, they in some cases took your business. So it's all of those same things we're talking about. It just hasn't been formalized with that letter grade or that number and shifting around. But we had vaccine passports, little analog things. If you were in New York, you might have had the Excelsior Pass Plus for your convenience, of course, but which digitized this. There are all kinds of groups that are associated with the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and Facebook and the Vaccine Alliance that are working on digital IDs. I mean, they're working on this sort of digital file, which, as you can see, would be very easy to kind of tuck in a social credit system.
Your permanent record, a digital permanent record.
Yeah,
that's fine.
Yeah, they called it the digital Dengon. And that was sort of the name that one of the sources gave it in China, which was that record, that file on you. And so, you know, we're not that far away. And then we have these, you know, assuming that we get around the big tech discussion here of them, you know, taking their payment systems away if you were on WrongThink or whatnot. But the government and the Federal Reserve itself are working on digital currencies. And you know, their ultimate hope is to be able to have full centralized control over the currency. And again, not a conspiracy theory. The G7 has put out their top principles collectively for central bank digital currencies, retail-facing ones, which means ones that consumers will use. There was a pilot program from the New York Fed with, you know, some of the major financial services institutions that happened last November. So these aren't the things that you do if this is something where they're like, yeah, that's never going to happen. Like, they're actively considering this and trying to figure it out. They're conflating it with cryptocurrency to try to make it palatable to people. And there are lots of different mechanisms for control where they can fully control that money and, you know, easily tie that with a social credit score or just whatever they feel like that day. And if and when that happens, that will be a complete loss of freedom, agency, and the ability to control your destiny and your wealth.
Carol Roth is joining us on the Snark Factor on Wham Talk Radio. She's a must follow on Twitter. If you're still on Twitter, you can find her at Carol J.S. Roth. You talk about how Americans may say to themselves, well, that's happening in China. You know, a lot of that stuff won't come over here. All we have to do is look to north of the border and what happened during the trucker protests and the marriage between government and tech to really trample on their rights. And it's something that if it could happen in Canada, it could certainly happen in California. Right. And then it creeps right into the rest of the
country. And then the California to DC pipeline kicks in and here we go.
That's what I say. It's like the incubator for bad ideas. Right. Beds like spread like a bad rash throughout the country. Right. Yes. Or cancer, as somebody said. Yes. But the crazy thing about the trucker convoy is that the marriage between tech and the government was actually the Canadian government and U.S. tech companies. And that was a mind blower that you had people in the United States who said, I agree with this in principle. I want to raise funds. They set up a GoFundMe. And this company, which is a U.S. domicile company, was contacted by the Canadian government. And instead of saying, you know, Justin Trudeau, go, you know, take a long walk off a short bridge. We don't care. We're Americans. They went, okay, yeah, we'll just shut it down. I think it was Canadian $10 million that they had raised. And then a hacker group said, well, we're going to support Justin. I mean, that's all these people supporting Justin Trudeau. I didn't hate to meet any, let alone all of these people. But these hackers, and they came out and said, well, this is like January 6th. Okay. So we're going to basically dox all the people who donated to this. And we're going to, again, institute our cancel culture, our social form of social credit. We're going to try to embarrass these people for participating in this. And we're going to try to hurt them financially by doing so. And that's, you know, that's kind of where we are. So we are like a stone's throw away from all of these things kind of lining up in a fully Orwellian way. It's already a you know, kind of Orwellian pieces of a puzzle, but like putting that whole narrative together.
This is a little outside of your book, but news broke this week that George Soros is passing on, you know, the business to his son, Alex, and, you know, the family business of radical left wing political influence.
Right. Right.
Do we know anything about Alex? Other than he's probably going to be worse than his dad.
I mean, so here's the thing. I mean, and I don't. So I'm just basically making stuff up now. So please take this. It's just me pontificating like improv, and none of this is at all research, which is the complete opposite of the book, which is fully researched. But like, I'm assuming Alex is a nepo baby. He's probably a giant loser. His dad is George Soros, and he's going to inherit this. And one of the things I have researched for my other books is that the phrase shirt sleeves to shirt sleeves in three generations is a real phenomenon worldwide. They have that phrase, like not just in the US, but like over in Asia, it's rice patties to rice patties in three generations. Like this is a traditional human nature phenomenon that like, you know, you get, it's kind of like the, you know, the hard times create strong men kind of cycle.
Yeah.
Is that like, you know, you get this person who works hard and is hungry and they go out there. And then you're the guy who's like, oh, I got like all these billions of dollars. Not certainly every single one of them. We have seen people step up. But like if you are going to Vegas and you're playing the odds on this, like you're playing the odds that like he's just going to end up blowing all the money on stupid stuff because people are like, this guy's got no influence. He's trading off his name. We'll just bleed him for all of his money and, you know, do whatever we want with it. So I hope that's the outcome. That would be a really good outcome, them to just suck all the money out that they can and just do nothing with it. But you never know. You never know what playbook, you know, George leaves behind, and as well as what in his legacy planning system, if he, you know, if he runs the plays, if he's got, you know, kind of the network entrenched. But I don't know. I just kind of feel like this younger generation, they're not as motivated to be as evil as their parents. So yeah, they don't work as hard at the evil stuff.
Well, for some,
he never had to build anything. So, right. So, like,
he didn't have to be
a concept of how to. So,
he didn't have to build an evil empire. He doesn't have a lair.
The sources get to enjoy generational wealth while the rest of us,
exactly. So, you know, we'll just hope. What would be really funny is for us to all create these like fake organizations. That would just like the whole point of it would be to like suck up second generation Soros wealth. I had an idea for the like privilege removal system where for people who felt like they had too much privilege, we could help them take their privilege and for a fee, of course, and distribute that, you know, privilege and their wealth and their homes and whatever to other people. So perhaps that's something that we could create a shell company and maybe, you know, stick somebody, not us, because obviously they know who we are, but they don't know. Like, we'll find some mark to be the front of it. And then maybe we can just suck all the Soros money out.
Well, redistribution. I love it.
Yeah.
I actually purchased the URL scampack.com. And I thought it would be fun just to film a fake campaign ad where I'm just completely honest with people and say, listen, I need you to donate $5 to the cause. I'm not going to do anything with your money other than buy myself a beach house. And just see how many people would send me.
Honestly, I feel like that's a huge one. I mean,
why not?
Yeah, I mean, capitalism, right?
Right.
capitalism tied with the political system. It's a winning combination, yeah. Fingers. I like it.
I hate to use the term crisis because it is so overused when it comes to just a number of issues. But when it comes to housing,
yes,
and you see what's going on with younger people today trying to buy homes. And I'm in central Indiana in a county where in my subdivision, it feels like now a good 30% of the homes in my neighborhood are rentals now because corporations have come in and just bought up the property. And, you know, and of course, homeowners associations are trying to step in and try to stop this. Do you see any way for this to be this movement to be slowed or halted, because there's no political will in Washington to slow any of this down?
Yeah. So there's two parts to this that I think it's important to understand. And obviously, and you will own nothing, I go into it in great detail, but there's the why are houses so expensive piece. And then there's why can't the young people afford them piece. And there's like, they're not a full overlapping circle, right? So the reason that housing has gotten to be so expensive has a lot to do with monetary and fiscal policy. There has been just an enormous transfer over the past, you know, 13 to 15 years, with an acceleration really over the past few years, of money from Main Street to Wall Street by policy. And this is like over the heads of many people. But after the Great Recession financial crisis, we all knew what happened. You know, everybody was a little bit greedy, but the people of America lost their homes due to foreclosures and to short sales. Millions of homes were lost. Wall Street got a bailout. And then the people who weren't directly involved on Wall Street just got an enormous amount of cheap capital based on policy that included, you know, suppressing interest rates and printing money out of thin air to try to, you know, expand the economy. But that all went to the wealthy people who went, oh, look, there are a bunch of houses at cheap prices. Maybe we should buy them. And when you have, you know, kind of money with the wealthy and well-connected, we saw that there was this what's called an asset bubble on Wall Street. In all of our terms, it's inflation. It's a different kind of, it's an asset inflation. But, you know, when they were like, oh, there was no inflation for all this. No, it was just in the assets, which the people who held the assets loved. Because if you own something, you want it to increase in value. But it wasn't being increased in value just based on, you know, basic supply and demand metrics. It was based on the fact that all the cheap capital was pumped into the market and it went into inflating the stock market and homes and, you know, other assets. Then on top of that, the craziest thing happened, and this did not exist before 2010. This was entirely due to the Fed's monetary policy and related government policy. But for the first time ever, as you alluded to, Fingers, we now had institutional corporate buyers going into the single family home market. You know, they were in the multifamily apartment rentals, whatever, but single family homes. The if you think of the picture of what the American dream is, and oh, by the way, is the largest source of wealth for households across the United States by dollar volume, right? That's why it's considered the American dream, because that's what drives wealth for people. So they're going in, and they started buying up like swaths of houses to the point that last year, one in every five houses was purchased by a corporate buyer competing with you for the American dream. And by the way, they're not buying them to like spruce them up and make them real nice and then sell them back to you so that you can, you know, have a nicer house. They're doing it expressly for the purpose of renting you back the American dream, because they want to take over that wealth that households accumulate and leave you owning nothing. And this did not exist before 2010. It is completely based on this ridiculous policy. So, oh, and by the way, other government policies, things like, you know, making it harder to build in certain places, them screwing up the labor pool via COVID, so there's not enough people to help build these homes. And oh, by the way, adding about $100,000 in regulatory costs to the average price of a new home. You know, all of these things makes it really hard and expensive for just anyone to buy a house.
Here's the other thing too, Carol. If we're being honest, Americans are a little bit to blame as well, because you look back at homes that were built in the 50s and 60s, and people were very happy with their 1500 square foot ranch. And now, because of the American lifestyle, it's like, if it's nothing less than 2500 square feet for a starter home, well, geez, I'm not interested. So, well,
kind of.
That extra square footage is going to cost you a little bit.
It is true. And I would say there's a piece of that, but it's also that because of the limitations, if you only can build so many homes in a year, which are you going to build? Are you going to build the 2,500 square foot homes, or are you going to build the 1,500? So, you know, part of that is factored into the equation. But you're right that things have, there's been an inflation in terms of expectations as well. But let's just put that to the side for a second. So we have these expensive homes over here. Then you have these young people. And what they have done is they have transferred their wealth in large part to college administrators. The government is the largest predatory lender in this country. I cannot believe more people don't talk about this. They take kids, sometimes minors, and lock them down with 5- and 6-figure debt amounts for educations that are worth a fraction of the amount. They don't allow for bankruptcy. They don't do any underwriting. They don't have the college have any skin in the game. And so the cost of college has ballooned as a factor of GDP and wages. And I'm slightly dyslexic, so I may get this backwards, but it's one or the other. So one of them's 5 and one of them's 8. I think it's 5 times GDP and 8 times wages. Possible. It's in the book. Possible that it's the opposite. But either way, you know, just exponentially higher than the growth of GDP and wages, which is insanity. So if you're going in to school to get an education, you think you're going to earn more. That is true, but it's not taking into account your balance sheet. Right. And now they've put so much debt that it doesn't make up for that small amount of increased wages that you have. And basically, it's actually making you less wealthy to go to college. So they can't afford not only, you know, to pay down the debt practically, but to then go ahead and buy a home. And it delays, if they ever even can buy the home, by more and more time, which means the assets inflating and you're just getting a wider chasm between the two, which is just fundamentally wrong. I cannot believe we don't have presidential candidates who are running on, we need to fix this. Talk about getting the youth vote. It's not like pausing this. It's like we're fixing the system because you're getting screwed over.
Well, it's amazing. You know, both of you are too young to remember this. but I remember a time when, you know, in high school, they taught home ec. And one of the things that they would teach you is basic economic skills. There would be not, you know, not people don't balance a checkbook like they used to. But you graduate from high school completely financially illiterate. And I used to think, well, you know, I'm just being an old fuddy-duddy, but really this is by design. Because if you were educated in any kind of business or finance, you wouldn't be signing the paperwork for these huge college loans, and you would be figuring out a way to investing your money early. This is all by design, isn't it?
It sure is. I mean, I'm saying this as someone, you know, I am about as old as you are, Fingers. And, you know, when I graduated from college, I had $40,000 of college debt back in the mid 90s. So we're talking, you know, on a today's basis, you know, that's 40,000 is the average today. Yeah. So it's back then. But my father was very, very focused on financial education. And he said, you have to figure out a plan. And I paid that off in a year and a half. Like, that was the focus. I only went to school and took on that much because I knew the outcome of the particular degree that I was going to in the particular school. And it was a very calculated, educated risk that was being taken. It's not like, hey, I'm going to study underwater basket weaving. I'm going to come out with I'm going to get a master's. I'm going to have $250,000 in debt. And it's like, the math doesn't work. Like, you're, I mean, just
people just don't buy that many baskets is the thing.
No, right? They right. really don't. Especially once it had been underwater for that.
Right.
They can
yes.
get moldy after a while.
Sure,
I find.
Sure. Of
so,
course.
Yeah, but it's insanity. And the fact that these colleges, who then, you know, some of them have these like massive endowments to the point where I call them hedge funds with universities attached or disguised as learning institutions. And you know, and that they're just happy to have, you know, this staff that does nothing. They're not increasing the learning staff. They're just increasing administrators. They're stealing money from young kids who have absolutely no recourse. Like, this is America. This is wrong. That shouldn't happen. And whether, I mean, you know, you could even also, they don't spend enough time talking about going to trade schools and right. other kinds of things that may be more appropriate and that could put you on that path to going and getting a fantastic job and investing. But it's funny. You're right, Fingers. I mean, my home ec class was in junior high and there was no economics. We learned how to make English muffins with American cheese and bacon on them, mm-hmm, which mm-hmm. was a really important skill because that's all I can cook today.
That's good. I learned how to sew a stuffed animal in my home economics class.
That's good. But I did have an intro to business class in high school, and that's where I learned all of these kinds of things. I also learned that my teacher was a total crook, and he had this thing that he did. He had this jar that if you like forgot your pencil in your locker or did need to go to the bathroom, that you had to put money into the jar. Yeah. And at the end of the year, that it was going to be used for a class party. And lo and behold, a couple days before the class party, that money was stolen. And the crazy thing about it, kids, is it gets stolen every year a couple of days before. So we did, I guess it was a good business lesson overall, right? That to learn right. not to trust your shady teacher and exactly. his little jar of, you know, sin or whatever.
A little punishment jar.
But yeah, we learn these things, and or at least I did. And, you know, my father reinforced that. But it's intentional. We know incentives relate to behavior, right? You incentivize the things that you want, you disincentivize the things you don't want. It's called taxes, it's called tax credits. We all know how this works. If they wanted you to own a house, they'd make it easier for you to buy a house in a, you know, relatable way, like in a removing some of the zoning and some of the regulation costs. If they wanted to make sure that, you know, you weren't stuck in this ridiculous financial system, they would get out of the student lending game. But they don't. They want you to be completely dependent on them because that's how they get their votes and their power. So they screw you over and they create this problem. Most people don't understand what the problem is or where it came from. And then they say, oh, hey, vote for me and I'll forgive your student loans, which, you know, we know isn't a thing, right? They don't have the power to do it. It's not their, they don't have any money. So if it was coming out of their pocket, if they wanted to pay for everyone's schools, great, but that's not how it works. Right. So, you know, this lack of financial literacy just kind of hits us from every angle. Go ahead. You know,
big tech just absolutely scares the heck out of me. And it's not just because of what we do with conservative content, but also, you know, I co-host a nationally syndicated show called Eat, Drink, Smoke, which part of the show we review cigars, and big tech has done what it can to censor cigar talk because they lump tobacco under all one umbrella, whether it's cigars, whether it's cigarettes, vaping, and it's all bad. And you know, you have to jump through hoops.
I thought it was because of Bill Clinton, but I see where you're going.
Oh, see,
it started there.
But it's absolutely one thing that's really struck me in your book. It's the name of the show is The Snark Factor.
That's fine.
But one of the things that really struck me in your book was you had some of the companies that were Dow Jones in 1997. And it was the traditional companies that you would think about of the 20th century, you know, General Motors, General Electric.
Yeah.
And now you look at the, you know, the biggest corporations in 2023, it's all big tech, you know. And you look at the old list, and you see some of the companies that fell off, you know, were bailed out to be able to still survive.
Right.
I don't see any end to be big tech anytime soon, to where, you know, some of these companies like Google, they're just going to get even more powerful.
Right. Like, what do we do without Google?
the size and the scope relative to kind of the world is what's really concerning to me, because, you know, I'm a financial numbers person. So if you think about some of these companies, they have more users than most countries have citizens. If you look at their market caps, it's bigger than the GDP of most advanced nations in this world. I mean, that is staggering. So it's not like we're talking about like Mr. Big Company that's got a couple billion dollars. Like, we're talking like, you know, trillion plus dollar market caps here. Right. And then what's a bother to me, because obviously, like, I'm a capitalism person, and I know my free marketeer friends say, oh, well, creative destruction, and eventually someone comes in. There's no competition. This is infrastructure. Like, if you think about mobile operating systems, I don't know if you guys caught this in the book, but two companies have the mobile operating systems that cover more than 99% of not just the US, but the globe.
The world, right.
So, like,
right.
What's the competition there?
There is no competition.
No, there's no competition. Right. So if you think about, like, let's say we were recording this over the phone, which I think, figures, when we first started, we actually did do.
Yes.
So we had our landline phones. You know, they couldn't say, listen, Sarah, Fingers, and Carol, you guys are a bunch of, you know, jack offs. We don't like you. We don't like what you're talking about. We're just going to shut your phone line down. Like, that didn't happen, and legally it was protected. They couldn't do that. They didn't care. They didn't get involved. We could say whatever we want. They weren't listening in, and they certainly weren't stalking, you know, you at work to make sure that, like, you didn't eat an extra donut out of the lunchroom or whatever it is. But now you've got these big tech companies who are private, even though, again, it's a kind of this cronyist infrastructure that they've benefited from. And if, you know, right now, I would say Apple's really good on privacy, generally speaking. They've, you know, done a few things, but overall, let's say they're pretty good. But what if they get a new CEO or a new set of people and they're not good on privacy? And then they're like, sorry, you can't have access to our operating system. Then you like almost cannot participate in modern society. Because
that,
this isn't just
that CEO's name will be Alex Soros.
And he's coming after us because we said we're going to try and suck up his money. And he's going to say, suck on this, Carol. Suck
so
on my
mad
operating
at us already.
System.
We just got put on the list, guys.
Yeah.
But that's the point is, you know, that you say something that's, you know, probably half in jest, you know, and you're just being a jerk or whatever. And then they don't like it. And they go, sorry. And like, what do I own here? I own some glass and some microchips and some plastic that if they're not configured in this way, I don't really do anything with it. But if I can't access the operating system and I can't access my email and I can't access social platforms and I can't access payment systems, I cannot be part of society. And it's like a de facto government. They're making up these things, but there's no Bill of Rights. We don't have the digital rights that we have no due process. There's no way to make it right. And so they decide, like, for the rest of your life, you're just, you know, sitting on the sidelines, you know, hoping that somebody will bring you one of those donuts from the lunchroom since you can't take two anymore.
Well, and as you call it in the book, I mean, that is World War F. Like, that is what this is, and you are just effed. That's it. Like, you cannot do anything.
It's true. And one of the things, you know, as I said, what's so weird is that when you think about war historically, you know, you're part of this country that's going out to conquer somebody else's country and their resources. Now it's the opposite. It's like everybody here's trying to come and take our resource. Like, that's not how war works. What are you guys doing? We're supposed to be plundering someone else, but the somebody else doesn't have enough money to plunder. So they have to legally plunder us. It's much more genteel. You know, there's not as much, you know, blood and ickiness involved. And, you know, they can just kind of do it by morality, executive order, law, whatever it is that they feel like it. And apparently a large part of the population is just like, okay, that's great. I'll help you enforce that. That's where we are.
Well, Carol, there's so much more we could talk about that we didn't touch on, you know, between central bank, digital currency, the U.S. role as far as the dollar and it continuing to be the world reserve currency. But we've taken up too much of your time as it is, but I will ask you one more question because, you know, I took the studio out.
You're greedy. Greedy, Fingers.
I am.
That's
a greedy capitalist. But, you know, I'm
Alex
outside.
Soros got to you, didn't he?
Yes. I'm outside. The birds are chirping. You know, I'm smoking my cigar and I want a little optimism, Carol. and you do offer at the end. You know, a little bit of optimism for everyone in the book. How can Americans protect themselves?
So this is the thing is the book is not meant to depress the heck out of you and for you to run and hide under your bed from now.
I'm sorry. I focus.
Eternity.
I'm a negative Nancy.
No, I get
Carol,
it. I get
I apologize.
I get it. But it is meant to empower you with that information because, as you can see, we just talked about just some of the things, and there's so many different things coming at us at the same time that we need different strategies for. So if we don't understand each one discreetly, we're not going to be able to kind of plan and prepare. And so chapter 11, here's my Easter egg for you, snark factor, guys. Usually chapter 11 is a bad thing, right? It's a bankruptcy. It's where you lose your assets. I've turned chapter 11 on its head. Chapter 11 is your battle plan to fight back. And it's really talking about the behavioral changes, including the financial changes that you have to make in order to be able to survive however long this takes. Because we can see the trajectory. Some of the stuff is going to be shorter term. Some of it's going to be longer term. We don't know the exact duration. So you have to kind of hedge your bets on how this all plays out and over what time frame. But it, you know, it depends. If something like a central bank digital currency is implemented and they can shut off access to your money for whatever reason, either because they're trying to quote unquote control inflation or because they said, you know, Fingers, you've smoked too many cigars this month and it's ESG and we don't want you to have any more. So we're just going to shut off your access for the next 60 days. You have to be thinking about, well, what's this alternate system that I'm going to be able to work in? You know, is it precious metals? Is it gold and silver? Am I bartering with people? Who am I going to? Where am I getting this? Am I building up, you know, people who are like-minded in my community that I can turn to? And, you know, that's just cigars, but I mean, I know that they're important to you, but things like food and medicine and, you know, other things that you might need as the stakes are shifting, it sounds a little bit preppery, but like, it kind of is a prepper light type of scenario that we're in. And so, you know, we do need to be thinking through these scenarios, which, you know, depending on your own financial scenario, it's going to give you the focus. If you've got a lot of debt, it's going to look different than if you've got, you know, a portfolio of assets that you're looking to protect. But that chapter is going to give you a lot of the things that we can do, A, to hopefully make sure a lot of this doesn't get implemented or to push back as they try to implement it. And then also the financial behaviors that you can adopt to you kind of insulate yourself, because we're not going to be able to stop a new financial world order from happening. It's history.
Not with that attitude.
Right. I mean, come on.
But we may be able to delay it, and we certainly can set ourselves up for, you know, as much success as possible during these chaotic periods. And that's really the ending message. It should be one of like, okay, I'm going to go get stuff done here. And I'm going to follow what these elite people are doing, not what they're saying. Cause I'm telling you guys, they're not giving up one iota of their assets. They're not looking to like, you know, not do these things that they're telling you you should do. And, you know, at the end of the day, they may want you to own everything or own nothing, but I want you to own everything.
So. They won't be eating insects anytime soon.
I don't think so. Not at Davos. I didn't see them on the last menu. Hear about that with the champagne and the caviar and stuff.
The book is You Will Own Nothing, Your War with a New Financial World Order and How to Fight Back. You could pre-order it now on Amazon or get a copy at your local bookstore on July 18th. Carol, thank you for being generous with your time. I would love to have you back because there's so much we didn't talk about that's in this book, but I don't want to give it all away.
Yeah,
to the folks.
No, it's good. We left them plenty of to meat to chew on.
Oh, yeah.
And next time we'll make it more fun and optimistic. This was a very heavy episode of the Snark Factor. I did my best to try to be obnoxious in at least a couple of places, but I feel like you know, we definitely need more of a session to really let that, you know, fly.
At the very least, we need you back before the beginning of football season so we could talk about your Chicago Bears and my Detroit Lions.
Well, hey, I mean, so we could just talk really, we'll give everyone a little preview. We got rid of Aaron Rodgers, so in the division. So like right now, we're all real happy about that. Like that gives, I mean, if they talk about there's any level of optimism, like that's really something to hang our hats on.
And I hesitate to point this out, but his last pass as a Green Bay Packer was intercepted by Kirby Joseph of the Detroit Lions, who knocked them out of the playoff hunt on the last game of the year.
And we appreciated that. You know, that's where you kind of get together and you say, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. And we're going to I mean, and here's the thing is that Aaron Rodgers is going out and saying things that make lots of sense. And I'm like, oh, don't make me defend Aaron Rodgers.
Right.
What are you guys doing? This is killing me. I don't want to defend Aaron of all people. But now that he's a Jet, I think we can sort of partially embrace some of the things that he's saying.
And very true.
That. Yeah.
Carol Roth, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, guys, for having me.